said, baby, what's the big deal? Feel what you wanna feel. Say what you wanna say. You're gonna die one day. For example, I could kiss you just because I want to. What's the difference if you turn away? I'm gonna die one day. Why do you waste your time?
Hi, podcast listeners. Chris here. A couple things to tell you about. This is another special edition that I recorded with my friend Yvonne the same day as the previous episode from last week, in which I go against my better judgment and respond to some of the criticism that Sexaton has received. As I explain in this episode, I don't like to really get into responding to criticism because it's kind of a no-win proposition. I'll talk about that in more detail in the episode. But anyway, if you're not interested in these sort of academic debates or, what people have said about the book and how what I think about that and so on and so forth, please feel free to skip this episode. Honestly, I find this kind of stuff sort of tiresome. And so I certainly won't blame you if you skip it. Because you might find it irritating too. I don't know. But maybe you're interested in what people have said about the book and what I think about that and dealing with aggressive interviewers and the sort of stuff that happens when you write a book that gets a fair amount of controversial coverage. Don't forget to check out suredesign.com for their t-shirts. They're fantastic t-shirts. We'll be selling them pretty soon. Some Sex at Dawn logos and some tangentially speaking t-shirts as well. On that front, I guess I can announce that I'm setting up a new website, a new site for the podcast, a new site for myself. So there will be all sorts of interesting technological wizardry being unveiled in the next few weeks. And I'm also thinking of maybe reducing the podcast to twice a month because I've got to write a book. I've got a contract for the next book and the deadline. I've pushed the deadline back twice now. And because I'm doing all this stuff with TV and talking to people about making documentaries and the TED conference that was last week, which was pretty amazing, but took a lot of time to prepare for and stress out about. Anyway, so my next book is due October 1st, and I've got to really start thinking about that and applying myself to that. So I was thinking maybe cut the podcast back to twice a month. The other thing I was thinking, and maybe once I get the website up, I'm going to have a forum section so you can give me comments and talk to each other and sort of have an online community for those of you who are interested in it. But I was also thinking about maybe doing some podcasts that aren't interviews where I can just sort of rave about certain things or rant and talk about some music that I'm particularly interested in and recent articles I've read and just stuff that's sort of on the top of my mind, sort of what Daniele Bolelli does, where he has one episode that'll be an interview and then the alternating episode is just him sort of going off into a microphone late at night somewhere. So I was thinking about doing that. Once I get the website set up with the forum section, I'll be interested to hear what you think about that once I start doing it. In any case, Sure Design t-shirts, very cool t-shirts, amazing designs, very good price. And I can vouch for the fit and the quality of the material. I've got a few shirts myself. They also look really good on women. The women's designs are very, very sexy, very cool. So check that out. And as always, you can get this podcast on iTunes and at feralaudio.com. And they've got some other great podcasts at feralaudio.com, like the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Everyone knows that's one of my personal favorites. It's about time for me to do another episode with Duncan, I think, either here or there, or maybe a joint recording or something. And it looks like I'm going to be on Joe Rogan's podcast again at the end of March, which is exciting. But what's really exciting is that I'm going to be picking up my Professor Stanley Krippner in San Francisco and driving him down so that he can appear on Joe Rogan's podcast, which I think is going to be really fantastic. Both my episode and Stanley's episode will be recorded the last week of March. So Joe normally throws those up right away. So look for me and Stanley on the Joe Rogan Experience at the end of March. Anyway, let's get to it. You'll hear me and Yvonne talking about one of the only academic reviews of our book that was negative. We got a lot of beautiful positive reviews, for which Casilda and I are very grateful, but we're going to talk about one of the only stridently negative reviews. So hope you enjoy the episode. And like I say, if you're not into this sort of academic dispute, then feel free to skip it. And next week's episode will be back to the interview format. Thanks for listening. Welcome to a special edition with Dr. Christopher Ryan. I'm the author of Sex at Dawn, the New York Times bestseller that Newsweek called a scandal in the best sense, but others have called a piece of crap, cherry-picked, inaccurate,
misrepresentation
of prehistory. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. You know, we've got a lot of reviews of the book, lots of blogs, lots of various things have come out. And a guy named Ryan M. Ellsworth wrote a review that was published by the Journal of Evolutionary Psychology online in 2011, last year, about a year ago. I don't remember what month, but you can find it online. It's called The Human That Never Evolved. He's at the Department of Anthropology, University of Missouri in Columbia. I don't know whether he's a professor or a grad student or what his situation is there, but he wrote this comprehensive, pretty comprehensive review. It's about 10 pages.
Yeah, he put the time.
He put some time into it. And at the time, I tweeted the review, and I think I said something like critical but not entirely unfair. And I would probably stick with that. I think... you know, I've resisted responding to this review and others for several reasons, one of which is, there's a cost-benefit analysis where, you know, you've got a certain amount of time, and if you respond to everybody who disagrees with you, you end up getting nothing done, right? So that's a great way to squander time. Then there's the psychological thing where you get into a negative, defensive position, and that's not a place I like to be. I feel like the process is you put your ideas out, you make your argument as well as you can, and what people do with that is up to them. I'm very resistant, as anyone who's heard me in any interview or read anything, any interviews I've done. I'm very resistant, for example, to the idea that we should be giving people advice, you know, that we should be. Mm-hmm. In fact, one guy, I think it was the Boston Globe, said, you know, everybody ends every review with me by asking about our marriage, right? What is it about, you know, what do you guys do? Do you have an open marriage? Are you swingers? Are you this or that? And Casilda and I agreed before the book ever came out that we weren't going to answer that question, because that puts us in all sorts of weird positions, like we're advocates for one thing or another. And what if it changes?
And know? In a way, it's beside the point.
Well, it's beside the point, exactly. In every way, it's beside the point.
Does it make?
You know, so this, like, but it's cool. I expect people to ask.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I would ask too, right?
Absolutely.
And this, but only one journalist really kept pushing, because normally what I say is our relationship is informed by our research, and that normally gets a laugh. Dan Savage laughed hilariously uproariously when I said that. He said, oh, that's going to be my answer from now on. Our marriage is informed by Christopher Ryan's research.
I'm using that.
So take that for what you will. But this one journalist from the Boston Globe kept pushing and pushing. And finally, you know, he said, yeah, oh, here you are. You write this book that's critical of monogamy, and you shy away. You try to run away from these questions about your own marriage. I said, hey, you know, if I had written a book about prostate cancer, would that give you the right to stick your thumb up my ass? And he didn't like that. He didn't laugh. I thought he would laugh, but he didn't. Anyway, so...
Did he respond?
I think that was the end of the interview.
Right. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't go well after that. So I kind of feel like responding to negative reviews is something authors should not do, because you can't win, right? You're not going to change anybody's mind. Yep. You're not gonna do anything except look like a petulant fool.
Yeah. The way I would see this review is finding very specific things that are being addressed.
Right.
And then just being like, here's my take on it.
Right. So that's what we're going to do today.
So we're going to do that today.
Yeah. Yvonne, who you're hearing on the other microphone there, owns these microphones. And the condition of using his sound equipment to do a podcast is that I have to respond to this.
No choice.
I've been saying no for months. And so finally, the compromise is I'll do it talking. So I don't have to spend 5 hours, you know, sitting at my computer writing it.
Yeah. Drink some beers and relax.
Exactly.
And talk about it.
So we're here with our hipster beers.
So one first thing that I'll bring up that pretty much the review starts with is a sentence where he says, I have failed to find one review in an academic journal or an evolutionary scientist or by an evolutionary scientist. Hmm. Basically saying this is just a book that went, you know, bestseller, but it's not like it's a scientific project. It hasn't been published in many almost approved by a bunch of evolutionary scientists.
Right.
So just a simple response to that, what would you have to say?
True.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Neither one of us teaches in a university. Neither one of us is, you know, publishing to survive. Yep. Casilda is a medical doctor. She's got a few articles in peer review stuff that she did through her career. And I've got a few things, but primarily I've written for a more popular audience. Yep. And
you're doing that consciously. You made that decision.
Right.
You were telling me.
Yeah. I mean, I have a PhD dissertation, you know, I've jumped through all the hoops, but, you know, as a non-academic, there's a legitimacy to publishing in the academic press that you're speaking to experts in your field. Yeah. But if what you're saying is disputes the sort of mainstream thinking, you're going to have a really hard time. You know, unless you're Einstein, and even Einstein had trouble.
Well, he had to really prove it.
Yeah.
Prove himself.
And I'm no Einstein, despite my hair at the moment.
Yeah, you're getting that.
But, you know, Casilda and I made the conscious decision to just leapfrog that process. And we talked about it. We actually thought of writing a very academic book. And then a few years later, write the popular treatment of the same material. Yeah. But then it was like, why bother?
Yeah,
why bother? I don't want to teach at Harvard.
So in a way, you're in a position where what I'm hearing you're saying is that the fact that this thing hasn't been published is not something that people would expect that if it's published, that it will give it merit.
Published, you mean?
In these scientific journals and going through
articles
and
stuff,
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you basically said, I found out something really interesting. And I'm just going to put it straight out into the world and put it out there without going through these processes that a lot of, you know, hardcore scientists would necessarily accept.
Well, and that's part of it. The other part is that the process itself shuts down alternative views. And let me tell you a story. Because when the book, the book initially... there were three publishers who were very interested, to the point where, you know, there was days before the auction, there was money on, you know, offers on the table, all this stuff. One was HarperCollins, who eventually published it. The other was Basic Books, which is an academic intellectual publishing house. And the third was Oxford University Press. Okay. We were very excited to publish with Oxford University Press because we met with the editor who was interested. She's great, really smart, very excited by the idea. We spent a couple hours with her having lunch in Manhattan, talking about how she saw the book, how she would shape it, and, you know, and, but Oxford University Press, because it is sort of a peer-reviewed academic house, they've got an internal peer review system.
So it would have had to go through the
process. It did. So she put it through the process. And the idea is they send it out to two experts who publish stuff with them.
Okay, and?
Anonymously, they write back with their analysis. So she said, you know, I'm sure this will be fine, but, you know, we have to go through this process. So she sent it out. And she got the first review back and she sent it to me with the names removed. So I didn't know who wrote it. And it was, I remember the review said, this is like Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, but better because it's about sex. More people will buy it.
All right.
And the review was just like, couldn't have been more positive. It was fantastic. So the editor sent me this saying, yeah, we're, you know, this is going to be great. This is wonderful. Then a couple days later, I get another email with another attachment, and she said, don't worry about this. I'm going to send it to a third reviewer. It'll be fine. And that review said, and I remember the line she said, or he, whoever wrote it, said, this book proposal is provocative in the sense that arguing that the earth is flat would be provocative. These people know nothing whatsoever about primatology. I assume this was a primatologist.
Okay.
Because the person really focused on the primatological thing. And said, it was just like, this is garbage. This is absolutely...
But why would a primatologist say this? That's like, why?
Well, you know...
If it is a providing that I'm assuming
what,
that it is
what, what really confused me about it was that... Now, again, I don't, because then the third review came back and that was negative as well.
Yeah.
So that's why we didn't publish with Oxford University Press, right? So I don't remember if it was this review or the third review, but one of the reviews said, you know, in making the case that we didn't know anything about primatology, this reviewer said, you know, they talk about how people argue that a human's had a polygynous system, a harem-based system. But that's absurd because no primate, living or dead, has ever had a polygynous mating system.
All right.
And I wrote back to our editor. I said, but gorillas have a polygynous mating system. Look at your own books that are... Oxford University Press published a book called Primate Sexuality, which is the definitive book on primate sexuality.
Okay, and
you read that, and it's all about how gorillas have a polygynous mating system.
Yep.
So whoever wrote this was, like, lost their mind. You know, it's ridiculous. It's like saying, you know, there are no basketball teams in Argentina. I'm like, well, but wait a minute. Of course there are.
So
they're in the Olympics.
Was there a response to that?
Well, that's the thing. So I wrote, and I said, but, you know, this is... You can... fact check this. And she said, no, I can't. She said, I can't get involved. It's the review is negative. It's negative. They say no. They say no. It doesn't.
So
I can't.
It's almost like someone in the academia doesn't like it and they just have a veto.
They veto it. And that's how peer review works.
Works.
You know, because the idea is you know your shit. So if you say no, then it's no. Because I don't know. I'm not a primatologist. I can't go and, you know, second check everything. So that's why we hire you to do it.
Oh, interesting.
Right?
Okay.
So there is a way, and I'm not saying this is the primary motivation we had, but there, you know, there is a way. It's very hard for new ideas to take hold in academia because there are a lot of people who are very threatened.
And they have their own momentum, whatever it might be.
They have their, you know, their position to protect.
Yep.
They have their ideas and their perspective that they feel very... I was talking with Helen Fisher, who's very well known.
That's
we
right.
talk about her in the book. I was emailing back and forth with her, and I was, you know, we were disputing, debating some things. And at the end, she said something I found very... touching and sad in a way. She said, well, my ideas are like my babies. I have to protect them no matter what. I thought, really? That's strange for a scientist, you know, that you are going to protect your idea, your perspective, your viewpoint, your argument, even if there's evidence that, you know, it's like, okay, your kid, you think your kid's wonderful, but your kid's out there, you know, raping and murdering, and the police keep, you know, coming to your house, and you're insisting your kid's wonderful?
Well, doesn't that go along with the whole standard narrative of privatization in a way?
yeah, privatizing one's ideas. Yeah, I guess so.
Right.
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of emotion in this stuff, right?
So there's two sides to it. Is one of those where you're like, and I think that's what I'm interested in. That's why I've been pushing for you to respond to this. Is not necessarily to respond exactly to what the person in this review said, but more to talk about exactly what we're talking about, which is there's one side which is potential people's egos, positions, different environments that they're in, that they're just not in a position or interest, they don't have the interest in wanting to address an issue like this. And then there's right. the other side, which is taking that aside, which is the kind of like, okay, the skeptics peer review, which is like, well, let's make sure this runs through the proper preview and actually gets looked at. And unfortunately, it seems to me is when it starts running through the peer review, is that you get a response and then you say, well, what about this? And then it seems to me that then it just, your response gets dismissed because of higher authority. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, well, like, and also, where do you end it? I am most in like an academic journal, you publish an article.
Yeah.
And then people write responses.
Yeah.
Individuals write responses. Yeah. And then you as the author have the right to one final response to like everyone all at once.
Okay.
That can't take, you know, point by point, but it has to sort of be a general summation of your argument. Yeah. And that's where it ends.
And that's it.
Yeah. So that's sort of the normal thing. So, you know, I think that's fair enough, right? You know, you make your point, they have detailed critiques, and then you say, well, okay, you know, da-da-da-da-da, which I guess is what we're going to do.
And then today. It just ends there? Because I think here's another interesting thing, is especially because this book, to a certain degree, comes in a package of being sort of a scientific publishing, right? Like it's not, it wasn't released as such thing, but it is something that presents a whole bunch of scientific research, right? So basically what I'm trying to say here is that it's like, even for myself and a lot of people, when they think of science and they want to be able to trust something, they're interested in what the process is, what is going on around this book, and what is going around all these other scientists saying different things, and what is going on when a review like this comes out and it doesn't necessarily get that's why I was pushing so much for him, like if someone writes a review of sorts, it's almost kind of like a duty of a scientist to be like, to at least be like, let's look at the certain points and just, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I am. I love to talk about the, say, cherry picking thing, which is kind of like to address that. For example, like when Ryan says, well, there's the bonobos who are, you know, you say there, this is basically, I think the point he makes is like, okay, well, they're very promiscuous, and you're using that to your claim, which is, well, that means we can use that to claim that humans are promiscuous. But then when they're not seen as being very violent, but humans are violent.
Right.
But that's not used as an argument either. It's like, well, then if bonobos are not violent, then how can we say that we can use them as an example if we are violent?
Right.
I think that's what he's saying, is he's really attempting to find kind of like turning the tables around and saying, well, you can't use bonobos in this context, but choose not to use them in this context. Right. So that's basically what I'm wondering. What do you have to say to that? Not necessarily to answer to it, but just...
Well, what I have to say to that is that that's bullshit. You can certainly use something as an example of one thing and not as an example of something else.
Right.
You know, I mean, we do it all the time.
Okay.
You know, I could use the banana sitting... I hit the mic there. I could use the banana sitting next to you on the bar as an example of a good breakfast food, but not as a good example of a doorstop. You know, I mean, there's nothing that says if you use, in biology, use an animal as a good example of something. I can use bats as a good example of flight, for example, but I don't need, that doesn't mean if later I'm talking about, nest building, that I have to use bats again.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
So different things are, different animals, different examples are relevant to different contexts.
Okay.
And the point he makes about violence is a particular point that I actually made notes about, because he says, you know, he says, well, humans are violent and therefore bonobos aren't a relevant example, because he expects, you know, that there should be this universal application of examples, which just is nonsense. But anyway, but what we say in the book, we don't say in the book humans aren't violent. We don't say that chimpanzees aren't relevant. What we argue in the book is that it's equally relevant to cite bonobos as it is to cite chimpanzees, and that 99% of the popular treatment of origins of human violence only talk about chimpanzees. And so we're not saying dismiss chimpanzees and only go with bonobos. We're saying, look, there are two sides to this, and you have to talk about the two sides.
So basically what you're saying is that let's not use bonobos as like the main thing that proves everything. You're saying if you're going to use chimps as an example, then please let's talk about this
exactly
as well.
Exactly. I mean, you're a twin, right?
Yeah.
Now, the best way to think of chimps and bonobos is like, you're a guy, you've got twin brothers, right? Okay. You're the human, your twin brothers are the chimp and the bonobo. Now, the chimp and the bonobo are more closely related to each other than they are to you.
Okay.
But they're more closely related to you than they are to your cousin, the gorilla, or your distant cousin, the orangutan, and so on. So it's, if you're going to say you're like your brother, the chimp, a violent asshole,
and
you're not going to mention your brother, the bonobo, who's not a violent asshole, that's a ridiculous argument, right? So what we're saying in the book is, you want to talk about primates? Fine. Talk about chimps and bonobos.
So what you're saying is you're clearing that point once and for all.
Which
is that's your point in this book.
That's the point of bonobos, and we make it repeatedly. Now there are ways in which bonobos are, we think, more relevant for talking about human sexuality than chimpanzees are.
Which is not relevant to the violence, necessarily.
Not necessarily, but, you know, both are relevant in terms of shared DNA, right? Because they share the same amount of DNA with us. But, you know, there are many things that humans have in common with bonobos in terms of our sexual behavior and our social behavior that we don't share with chimps, right?
Yeah.
For example, having sex face to face, right? That's unique between us bonobos. Check, please. That's it, right? Among mammals. So that's extremely significant. The position of the vulva on the female toward the front of the body, the extreme sociability, the fact that the female bonobo is willing and able to have sex throughout her menstrual cycle. Chimps don't do that. Chimps have an ovulatory period. Yeah. It's prolonged. It's longer than in most mammals and includes many days in which she's not actually ovulating. But bonobos, it's all the time, right? And humans. Who else? Dolphins, right? Interesting. All very intelligent, very highly social, living in large social groups, complex communication. You know, we share a lot of things. And so what we're arguing in the book is that sexuality is like grooming. It's like communication. It's a form of interaction that is both a result of and a way of perpetuating these complex social arrangements, right?
And it seems to me that the bonobo example comes only when there's talk about chimps. It almost seems to me that you could just take both chimps and bonobos out of the picture and just look at the humans for what they are and explore just that on itself.
Which we do.
Which you do as well.
I mean, the book has four major sources of information. The primatology, where we say, okay, we're going to talk about primates, then let's talk about the primates that are closest to humans, chimps, bonobos, right? We'll use gorillas as an example of a different type of breeding system, different body type and so on. But essentially, you know, people so often when they're talking about sexual behavior and biology, they'll say, you know, let's look at the dolphin. Let's look at the prairie vole. Let's look at, you know, swans or whatever.
Okay.
If you want to understand your dog, you know, your dog's shitting on the carpet and you want to understand dog behavior and dog.
Perfect.
You look at wolves and foxes, right? And coyotes. You don't say, I want to understand, why is my dog shitting on the sofa? Well, you know, let's go study penguins. Like, what? Penguins have nothing to do with this, you know? Human beings do not build nests and lay eggs. So who gives a shit about the penguins? Enough with the fucking penguins already. So the point is, you want to have a biological argument, fine, but it's got to be chimps and bonobos. That's where we have to start, and
that's
and they're equally relevant.
Okay.
We're more closely related to chimps and bonobos than a dog is to a fox, or an Indian elephant is to an African elephant.
All right,
right, and then you get to gorillas and orangutans; it gets much more distant very quickly. So that's the point. Now, getting back to this thing with violence. Now, we say explicitly in the book, asking whether humans are violent or peaceful, generous or stingy, jealous or sharing, is like asking what's the natural state of H2O.
Okay.
It depends. It depends on the context, right? H2O can be a gas, it can be a liquid, it can be a solid.
Yeah.
Human beings can be murderous bastards. We can be incredibly peaceful, wonderful, generous to strangers. Yeah. It depends on the context.
Yeah.
So this idea that, and this often happens in reviews, where they say, oh, they say humans are bonobos. We're not bonobos. Just look at us. We're nothing like bonobos. We kill each other and we rape it.
All right.
Okay, you're missing the fucking point.
Okay, I got
First,
you.
We don't say we're like bonobos.
Yeah.
You know, secondly, the fact that we exhibit behavior in the modern world that the bonobos don't, sitting in a, you know, in a zoo or in a jungle in Congo, doesn't really prove the point.
Now, do bonobos that are in the zoo, do they get violent?
No, that's what's so interesting. No bonobo in captivity or in the wild has ever been witnessed to rape, kill another bonobo.
But humans would.
Humans would.
That is the argument, right?
Well, humans...
It means that we're not as adaptive as
some
bonobos?
Humans do, some humans don't.
Okay.
Right?
We've had much longer time of being in closed-off places than bonobos might have.
We have much bigger neocortex, which means we're more susceptible to cultural conditioning and training and, you know...
Convince ourselves of stuff and beliefs and cultures and stuff which bonobos might not have.
You know, one thing I say when in interviews, often this comes up, right? And I try to make this point that we're not saying humans are, you know, inherently peaceful, you know, the noble savage.
It just depends.
Okay. It depends, right? But here's the caveat. Nobody in the world is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because they helped a stranger.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of training to get most people to kill another person.
All right.
Right? It's traumatic.
Yeah.
To hurt another person. I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're a surgeon or a dentist or a tattoo artist. Every time you go to work and you cut into someone and you hurt somebody, even if you know intellectually you're doing it to help them or they paid you and they want you to do this, it hurts you.
And you talked about the whole thing during the war. It's a specific war where they found out that they were
shooting above the Japanese. Yeah, there was a great article in the New Yorker about that, which I think we cite in the book, where they found that the Japanese were rushing them on these islands in Okinawa and these other islands, and the guys were still shooting above their heads.
So the point being is, like, forget bonobos, forget chimps even. Just look at human behavior in itself, and can we just look at that and learn from it?
I think there's clearly a tendency, you know, if we have a choice, most of us opt toward love, not toward...
Let's resolve this.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the only caveat. It's like the sexuality thing. It's like saying, okay, look, they're both relevant, but we have a lot more in common with the bonobos than we do with the chimps.
Let's not ignore that fact. Like,
exactly.
Let's talk about it. Okay,
exactly.
That's, you're introducing a new conversation and seeing what people are interested in talking about it. That's the point, right?
Right. There was a review in the Atlantic review. It was on a blog, I think, on the Atlantic by Megan McArdle, who's an economist. She hated the book, right? And it's like, again, this gets into the emotional aspect of some of these reviews. Now, I'm not saying everyone who doesn't like the book has, you know, an emotional response and so they should be dismissed, but I am saying that about her.
Well, it's easy to trigger. Like, there's a lot in this book that goes against the standard narrative.
Right.
And if someone's really going along the standard narrative and someone flips the page,
people feel threatened. If you say, you know, it's natural that you or your partner are attracted
been living
to other
their whole
people.
Life like that
or someone just got married.
Yeah.
You know, and in her case, she didn't even read the book. She said in her blog thing, she said, you know, I'm only like six chapters into this book, but I already can tell it's garbage. It reads like horse feathers. And there's, and then she said, like, they wrote this whole book arguing against monogamy and they never mentioned jealousy. It's like chapter 13 is called jealousy.
Speaking of the jealousy, I love your quote, or when you say, you know, remove fear from jealousy and what's left.
Yeah.
And you know, people can come and speak to that. And that would be a great conversational topic for anyone who wants to talk about jealousy in itself, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So do you want to address, you had a few things that you want to specifically just address around the review. Do you want to quickly cover it?
If you want. I mean, I don't know what you had to talk about, but I looked through the review this morning. I hadn't read it in a long time. I mean, there are lots of things, you know, where I could go through where I think he takes cheap shots. I know he takes cheap shots. Like,
all right.
Like on page 327, he says, you know, this despite abundant unmentioned ethnographic evidence of territoriality and territorial intergroup aggression among hunter-gatherer populations. See, for example, Keeley, Manson, Rangnum. We mention all those books. All those books are mentioned in Sex at Dawn.
Okay.
So it's like, yeah, dude, I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons I didn't want to respond to this, I'm assuming this guy's a grad student. And okay. When he wrote this, he was a grad student. And one of the things you do as a grad student is you write book reviews.
All right.
I did it too.
So he just chose your book?
Well, he chose the book because lots of people are reading it. It's relevant to stuff he knows. So, yeah. You know, he's read the literature. Okay. And the thing is, I've got a certain amount of sympathy for someone like him, meant in the Latin sense, where I feel what he feels. That,
yeah.
Because I did this too. You're looking for a book to argue against.
So that's the point, is to argue against rather than...
You're learning critical thinking, right? That's what you're learning. So you want to bring your critical thinking to something. You want to show how it's wrong. You want to show how they're...
And that's the point of it.
And you know more than they do. And so you're impressing your professors and you're impressing, you know, it's part
and you,
of...
And you kind of have to do it.
Well, it makes sense because if you write a book saying, you know, you write a review saying, oh, I read this book and it's really great and these people are wonderful and oh, it's so wonderful. And they're arguing against, by the way, what you've been teaching me, what this department believes, what, you know, the head of the department has been publishing.
Gotcha. All right.
You're not going to write that review. And if you do, it certainly isn't going to help your career.
So he's almost in a position where he has to find certain holes to poke on, to like get on and then you're...
Well, it's definitely advantageous to him. Do that, gotcha. You know. No, I'm not saying that it's invalid or whatever. He does make some good points. He does point out some things where our reasoning wasn't as clear as it could have been, whatever. So I don't mean to trash him individually or personally, but that's what writing reviews like, especially for an academic journal, especially when you're a grad student.
All right.
I mean, I can't tell you how many books I trashed when I was in that stage.
Oh, okay. So the idea here is with this review, in a way, is like as much as we address it, the idea is like people can read the review and it's almost like whether you respond to it or not is that it's out there and it's, you know, just open for people to, you know, look into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully more thoughts and research can come out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, this is the problem with getting into a back and forth about these sorts of things,
right.
You know, because it quickly becomes very, you know, in the weeds, very, very specific.
Like, for example, specifically, here's I found the foragers, not horticulture. Like he says, it is interesting that indeed that Ryan and Jetha approvingly cite horticultural societies as affirming evidence of the sexually promiscuous nature of humans, and a purported lack of universal concern over paternity, while at the same time rejecting the horticultural societies as a representative of ancestral humans in their discussion of warfare on the grounds that are not foragers.
Right, right. They're attempting to have their cake and eat it too.
That's right.
Right, yeah. Well, the problem with that is that different context has different relevance to different behavior. Okay, I think I said that earlier about the bananas, right?
Yeah.
So if you cite a particular culture saying, you know, their sexual behavior seems relevant to this argument that we're making, that it's not then incumbent upon you to go back to that same culture when you're talking about their whether or not they have warfare with other groups.
Okay.
Because if what creates the conditions that give rise to warfare are different than the conditions that affect sexual behavior.
All right.
Okay. So those are two very different kinds of aspects of arguments that you're making. And okay. So if you have to use every example for everything you talk about, the book just turns into a mess.
To play a devil's advocate on this one, like I could argue on that case is that sex, in a way, through your writing, is being used as an argument to say, well, sex is supposed to alleviate aggression. It's supposed to help people maintain complex dynamics in humans and try to resolve things in a nonviolent way.
Well, so not supposed to, but that it does.
It does. Okay, in that case, it seems that warfare, if people are more if people are more in a society where sex is more accepted, they would more kind of lean towards wanting to have issues and conflicts be resolved in a more nonviolent way as a result.
No. And as a matter of fact, that's what the data show.
So the point being then is that if there's a warlike people, but they're also, then it makes it a similar issue. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, it doesn't really make it a similar issue. There is that overlap. There is commonality.
But you're the problem, also saying that there is...
There's like, so much more. The sort of principal, primary things that give rise to war have nothing to do with sex.
Sex, okay.
I mean, I remember there's a book called War, a recent book by Sebastian Junger.
Okay.
He was... embedded with Marines in Afghanistan in the Korangal Valley, I think it was, which is like, you know, the point of the spear of the American presence in Afghanistan. He was with these guys who were attacked every day, and it was a big thing. Anyway, I saw him doing an interview, and I don't remember where, but the interviewer said to him, so why did these guys fight? Why are they there? They don't give a shit about geopolitics or, you know, whatever the oil pipeline they were going to run through there or, you know, heroin trading or whatever, all these different explanations for why it makes sense to have all these, you know, this military presence there. They're not motivated by that. What were they motivated by? And he said, love.
All right.
They fight for love because they love each other. Because they got each other's backs, because they've been through boot camp with these guys, they've been, you know, to hell and back with these guys. So what they're fighting for is love.
All right.
Right? So that's why when we talk about war, especially in the modern age where it's so institutionalized, it's so, you know, like, why do you join the military? Well, because my father and my grandfather were in the military. We're a military family. That's what we do, right?
And some people are just bored.
Or you're bored, or you didn't finish high school and you don't see any career path, or the economic conditions have forced you into a place where that's your only possibility of getting a job and an education. So it's very hard.
More complex.
Right. So if you're going to talk about what makes a society warlike or not warlike, you can't just say, oh, look at the way they have sex.
So it seems to me that reviews like these need to get really, really specific if they want to be able to criticize any specific aspect, because it branches out pretty quickly.
Well, the other thing is that there's sort of a cognitive trick that this guy does and other reviews have done is that they switch the debate around. Okay, what we're doing is we're saying, look, the standard narrative, which is that since the beginning of time, men have traded certain resources. Protection, meat, status, shelter, and so on, to women in exchange for sexual fidelity, because these men have been obsessed with their paternity, that men everywhere and always have wanted to know that those kids belong to that guy so that that guy doesn't invest his resources in someone else's kids, that is intrinsically human. That's built into our DNA, right?
And you're saying that's...
That's what we're arguing against.
Gotcha.
Okay? So we are arguing against an argument that says this is universal.
All right.
So what we're doing is we're saying, well, but what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? We're showing a dozen or two dozen exceptions to that rule. And we're saying, wait a minute, if you think this is built into our DNA, then why are there so many exceptions? Why are there so many problems with living the way you say is our nature, right?
Okay.
So we're not saying everybody is promiscuous.
Yeah.
We're not applying any universal rule. What we're saying is your universal rule is bullshit. because we've got 100 different exceptions. So then if you turn switch it around and say, oh, well, wait a minute. If you say, you know, the promiscuous, this culture is promiscuous and that we're peaceful, then what's this exception and that exception?
It's almost like getting into a religious debate.
Well,
you know, it's kind of when you're saying, well, yeah, you're the one who's posing this idea.
It's a religious debate with a believer. And I'm not a believer.
Exactly.
I'm saying I'm a skeptic.
Gotcha.
And so if you're turning it around and you're saying, no, wait a minute, you know, this example you use, there's, you know, you're cherry picking. Well, of course I'm fucking cherry picking. Okay. But I've got a big bushel of cherries here.
Yeah.
And you're the one who's saying that's an apple tree.
Okay.
I'm saying, dude, look at all these fucking cherries.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So that's, I mean, if we're going to sort of boil it down, that's essentially what a lot of these things do.
Okay.
First, they misrepresent our argument.
Yeah.
That we're arguing for some universal, that all humans are bonobos or something.
Okay.
And the second thing they're doing is they're saying, you're cherry picking. And we're saying, yeah, we are cherry picking. But we're arguing against your assertion of a universal human code
or whatever.
Nature. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Well, okay, well, that's pretty clear. I'm pretty happy.
Is that
with this
clear?
Response.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, like, the thing with this is that we can go into the details of analyzing every single of the points, but
right.
It seems to me that it's not about that at this point. It's like.
Yeah, and see, the thing is, and we can sort of wrap it up with this, I think, that I'll just read from near the conclusion. He says, to argue that the evidence points to the level of promiscuity argued by Ryan and Jetta is to turn a blind eye to disconfirming inconvenient facts. Okay? That's where he articulates the switch, right?
Okay.
We're not arguing that there was a particular level of promiscuity of every human in all of history. What we're arguing is that our ancestors typically,
yeah, there was a whole lot of it.
Typically had more than one sexual partner in an ovulatory cycle.
Okay.
And our body reflects that, as does our behavior, as do our appetites, as do the behavior of hunter-gatherer societies and horticultural societies and modern societies all over the world. So we're saying that there are these, you know, sort of evolved tendencies that we have. But we're not saying everybody was promiscuous all the time. Anyway, he continues, while indulging in quite a bit of fantasizing, that's the other thing, they sort of trivialize us and me particularly as, you know, just...
Fantasy world?
Fantasy. If promiscuity, even slightly approaching bonobo levels, were characteristic of post-Homo erectus, again, we don't say we fucked as much as bonobos do.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
We just say we had a lot more sex than that standard model claims we did.
Yeah.
Right? Anyway, he says, if it was even close to bonobo ancestral sexuality, there would be much more evidence of it than Sex at Dawn manages to drum up. 320 some pages of evidence. I don't know how many citations, there would be more. Ryan and Jetta conjure up a phantom of human nature that vanishes in the face of scrutiny, a naive vision of a human that never evolved.
Okay, so it's... Okay.
Okay? Now, nowhere in this review does he talk about the fact that human beings have sex on average about 1,000 times per birth.
Okay.
Which is double that of chimps and bonobos, and 100 times that of gorillas.
Yeah, yeah.
Nowhere does he talk about the correlation between turbocharged sexual behavior and large social groups of highly intelligent communicative animals like dolphins and bonobos Right? And nowhere does he talk about the fact that among the hundreds of primate species, many of which live in large complex social groups with multiple males, there are none that are monogamous. There's not one that's monogamous. So again, he's switching the argument around, putting us in the position of saying we have to defend some... it's like a war where one side's in a castle and the other side's on horseback.
Okay.
And they're saying, no, you have to defend the castle. And we're like, yeah, we don't have a castle.
Okay.
We're just saying, you know, your castle is about to fall, you know?
Okay, I understand.
Yeah. Right. So,
you know, props are actually taking the time to do this because I've been bugging you for like a year. almost. So it's because for me, that's what I actually, that's what I think it counts for, is like to actually take the time to be like, I'll at least acknowledge that this was written, and I'll at least take some time to at least speak to it.
Right.
You know? Because it's, I think that whoever you're approaching out there in the world where you're actually saying things, where it's Pinker or Fisher or whoever it is, I think it would be great to hear at least a response around, well, here's at least my thoughts around it, rather than just a total dismissal, like, oh, I don't have time for that. Because, yeah, I agree that, like, sometimes you don't have time, but to actually find the time at least to say this thing is just great. So, yeah, thanks for doing that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm happy.
And I wish Ryan M. Ellsworth all the best.
Yeah, same. We're all in it together, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As a bonobo, you know, I'm just a bonobo, right? That's all we are.
My twin brother's a chimp.
Exactly. All right. So wrap it up. So welcome and welcome. Thank you. You know, ciao. Ciao in Italian ciao means out. It means both welcome and, you know,
I
see ya.
I use that one all the time.
Yeah. I said the other day I was in the elevator with a couple of Chinese ladies. And when I left, I said ciao. And then later I thought, did they think I was being funny? You know,
maybe
did they
think of chow mein?
Yeah, did they think I was trying to speak Chinese to them? You know, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway,
it's nice to leave people confused sometimes. It's good for them. You know?
Okay, so thanks to listening to another confusing podcast. I hope it didn't come across too mean spirited and petulant. Yeah. And Ryan M. Ellsworth, if you hear this, you know,
hope it spoke to you.
Best of luck to you, buddy.
Okay,
we'll catch you next week. Thanks. Bye.
Ciao.
Baby, what's the big deal? Feel what you wanna feel. Say what you wanna say. You're gonna die one day. For example, I could kiss you just because I want to. What's the difference if you turn away? I'm gonna die one day. Why do you waste your time thinking about your reputation? Trying to meet an expectation, wondering what they're gonna say. When everyone you ever know set it for a headstone, I don't wanna give the end away, but we're gonna die one day. Your body is an animal, doesn't ask for much. A little music and a soft touch, why don't you let it out to play? Heart is in a birdcage, singing in your chest. You wanna shut it up or give it a rest? You're gonna die one day. Why do we waste our time thinking about an obligation? Running from a confrontation, wondering what we ought to say. When everyone we ever know said for a headstone. Up in my arms, and if we must go down, we'll go singing to the smoke alarms, we'll dance into the ground.